once again for taking the time to download and listen to the Nine Year Old Chronicles. This is Season 8, Season 72-73. It's an incredible season for Hibs, which you'll hear on the podcast. And playing underneath just now is You'll Wear It Well by Rod Stewart. And at the end, for the second season in a row, we get something by Tony Orlando and Dawn. It's Tie a Yellow Ribbon. I'll tell you about the TV later at the end of the podcast, and also based on the songs the boys sing on the podcast that were popular at the time with the supporters, is another song that was kept off the charts by Tony Orlando. It was number 2 for 4 weeks. Anyway, enough of me. This is Lackey Moore, Robert and St Anthony with Season 8 of the Celtic Underground 9 in a row.
Thinking, I bet he's sinking, or he wouldn't get in touch with me. Oh, I ain't begging for losing my head.
So we are progressing down the line, and we are thundering towards the conclusion of the Nine in a Row Chronicles, because this is Season 8, Season 72-73. It's a season where Celtic win the league, losing the League Cup final again, losing a Scottish Cup final, losing a Drybrough Cup final, which last week we didn't talk about, but we're going to talk about this week. Knocked out the European Cup in the second round. So we're going to get started on the Drybrough Cup, which we didn't talk about last week because I decided to pass it by because it's a short-term competition that the fans didn't really treat as a proper competition. But this season I decided to talk about it because it's interesting, because this season they trialled no offsides in the Drybrough Cup. So, Lackey, you were at Drybrough Cup games this season, so tell us a bit about the Drybrough Cup.
Well, I remember most was the final, because it was a high-scoring final against the Hibs. I think Jim O'Rourke, if I remember right, got a hat-trick. And I think a game went to extra time.
Yep.
But they obviously beat Aberdeen in the semi-final, which was a change from the previous season, but Aberdeen had won the Drybrough Cup, which set them up for a good season, up to the point where they fell away. And the Drybrough Cup final, I remember, because I was most irritated at Tommy Callaghan. Now, I know Tommy Callaghan is much loved by the Celtic support. He was never my favourite player. And on that day, I was convinced that the Hibs had worked out that if you gave him the ball, he would run up the wing and run out the pitch. So, in the way that you... I remember him... Who was that Kilmarnock manager when they beat us in the League Cup final recently? His son played...
Kenny Shields
said that on that day, they were quite happy to give Victor Wanyama the ball, because for all his many qualities, he was not a great passer of the ball, he said. So they were quite prepared to let Victor have the ball, because they didn't think he'd do any damage. Well, I felt for years after that Ryder Cup final that Hibs had sussed out that Tommy Callaghan had qualities, but he was not a great passer of the ball compared to some of our players. And they let him run up the wing, and the number of times he ran it out of play was most irritating. But it was a brilliant football match, and Jim O'Rourke had a magnificent game for the Hibs. I think Celtic came back from a couple of goals down to get to 3-3, and then in extra time, Hibs scored twice.
They were 3-0 down, George.
That's right, I thought that, yeah. I mean, it was a good recovery, but Hibs were deserved winners. Mm. I liked the Drybrough Cup. I thought it was a bit better than playing pre-season friendlies.
Yeah, so they done.
And so, St Anthony, why was it called the Drybrough Cup for the younger, uninitiated supporters?
Well, the whole thing about Drybrough is that they were a brewing company, and this was the advent of sponsorship as we know it now. I think down in England there was a thing called the Watney Cup, which was another brewer. And I'm not sure if there was a link between Watney and Drybrough, or maybe Drybrough had just saw an opportunity to do what Watney had done. But the my recollection of the Drybrough Cup is that they were keenly contested games, as George says. They weren't these meaningless friendlies that you get these days. And there was also it wouldn't mean a great deal of money, but there was a financial incentive. I think for winning it, you get something like £10,000, which in those days was huge. The reason that you qualified for the Drybrough Cup was it was the four top scorers from the previous season in both leagues. So it was a nice wee curtain raiser to the season, and we were always involved in it, but we didn't do particularly well. We used to get to the final and get beat. I think Big Jock used it as a means for getting the players sharp for when the real big games kicked in.
But as we were talking about earlier, that was they did away with the offside, and they changed the offside rule for that particular season in the Ryder Cup. Was it you couldn't be offside outside the 18-yard line or something? What exactly was the change that they made?
I'm not sure exactly the detail. I think you couldn't be offside. You could only be offside in the 18-yard box.
That's right.
Yeah. So you couldn't be offside anywhere else apart from in the 18-yard box.
Because the line in the pitch went right across the 18-yard line. I remember thinking that was pretty weird.
It was a bit like Sabutio pitches, wasn't it? You know, you used to have the thing of Sabutio.
So you can't score outside the white line.
Yeah, exactly. So I suppose the principle of having a competition where you can trial out slightly different rules would be beneficial. But we'll move on since we lost it and we don't want to talk about it.
Well, there was crowd trouble.
Well, I was going to say, the one thing that there was, because we touched on this last week, that it was the start of seeing crowd trouble. There was crowd trouble at the final because there was no segregation back then.
That's right.
Yeah, I was, after being hit by a glass at the Scottish Cup final against Hibs 3 or 4 months earlier, I decided to move to the North Enclosure for this Drybra Cup final. And there was a rammy in the North Enclosure, which I think was split between the two sets of fans. So I remember that well. But same as Lackey, Jimmy O'Rourke scored a fantastic goal in extra time after we'd come back from 3 down. And I think Evan Williams didn't have a great game for us. And disappointing to lose it again. I think the crowd was only 50,000, whereas there had been 106,000 at the Scottish Cup final. So that says something about what the public thought of it. Drybra was actually a subsidiary company of Watney Man. They were just the Scottish Scottish arm of Watney's, who were famous for their red barrel at that time, which is something that I would never drink, but. And then we moved on to the League Cup. And I think what had been a kind of enterprising 3 tough games in the Drybra Cup then fell away to a really boring League Cup section for
mediocrity.
Mediocrity in the extreme. You know, so having eliminated Rangers 4 times in the previous 5 years at the group stage, we got a draw, a League Cup draw with Arbroath, East Fife and Stirling Albion. And they were virtually all forgettable matches. I was at most of them. Mm. And bear in mind, Arbroath and East Fife were both top tier clubs in the First Division that year. They both stayed up quite comfortably. So they're not in this kind of shape that they're in right now. But we failed to beat East Fife at home, and it took a late Kenny Dalglish goal to get us a draw. And after there had been a fire at Parkhead, there was a couple of games played at Hampden. The game against Arbroath, I remember, one of the lowest home crowds in our history, less than 5,000 for a game at home to Arbroath at Hampden. Finished 3-3. We'd been 3-1 up. A guy called Derek Rylance scored a hat-trick for Arbroath that night, and I'm not sure what else he did in his career, but that was a great night for him. The most interesting thing of the 6 section matches was the first match at Stirling Albion away, where Jock Stein went into the crowd at half-time with Bob Rooney as a bit of support to confront a number of the fans because of what had been some vile chanting and singing in the first half. So Steen, there had also been crowd trouble at that game with the police behind the goal, and Steen just went in. And
what was it they were singing, Robert?
I think they were singing songs.
What was it, the Republican chants? So.
It could have been, but I think it was. Steen went in there, confronted them, massive applause from the fans, and the singing that he disapproved of ceased. So it was quite a move. And Jock Stein said afterwards he did feel a slightly uncomfortable sort of jumping over the the barrier to get in and to go into a crowd, and what was, you know, there might have been a bit more of hostility. Certainly Bob Rooney as backup was a good idea, but, you know, it worked out well. Steen got a lot of praise for taking that action.
Was it not seeded?
It was seeded. Yeah. That's why it had been quite a poor draw. It was maybe, you know, I know the League Cup sections ran for a bit after that. And in fact, we got Rangers the following season in our League Cup section. But, I mean, just like everything else, seeding was starting to come into place. And
do you think the seeding was brought in because they were... not just Rangers, but the organisers were fed up that Rangers kept getting knocked out in the group stages because they kept getting drawn against Celtic?
Possibly.
I think that's part of it. And, you know, as we've discussed in the last few podcasts, teams like Ayr United, Dumbarton were getting to the semis. So it was, to me, it's a true cup competition if it's an all-in draw. And, you know, I think the Champions League's been ruined by seedings in, you know, in the last 10, 15 years, it's not so interesting. So, yeah, we got through, obviously, with 4 wins and 2 draws. And Dougleish scored in all 6 games, which was a fabulous start to the season for him.
And we then get into the second round where we beat Stranraer over 2 legs, quarterfinals. We beat Dundee we won in Dundee 1-0. We won at Celtic Park.
We lost
1-0 away. We won at Celtic Park 3-2, making it 3 each in aggregate, meaning there needed to be a quarter-final replay.
Yeah, that was interesting because there was no away goals count double. So with the tie having finished 3-3 after the second leg at Parkhead, which I remember being there that Wednesday night, and Jockey Scott scored a tremendous goal for Dundee to level the tie, but there was no away goals count double, and therefore it was decided to have a playoff at Hampden a week or so later. But the game at Parkhead was one where Jock Steen had marched out onto the pitch to have a few words with Bobby Davidson, who was the referee that night, and there had been a couple of very controversial decisions. Dundee's first goal had been controversial because the linesman had had his flag up that the ball had gone out of play over the touchline, but Davidson ruled the goal could stand. And Steen got fined a few weeks later by an SFA disciplinary committee for what he had said to Davidson. Davidson was still in charge for the playoff game at Hampden 10 days or a couple of weeks later. Which we played brilliantly. And we were a goal down, but we were 4-1 up by half time, and that was us into the semis.
Just interesting on the Jock Steen confronting Davidson. It was the third time that Jock Steen had been in front of the disciplinary panel for something he'd said to a referee, and it was the third time that the referee had been Bobby Davidson.
Well, one of them had been, as we discussed before, that Aberdeen Cup final in 1970, where a number of decisions went against us. And so I think, you know, just continuing with the League Cup, really tough semi against Aberdeen, and finished 3-2. Seem to remember Tommy Callaghan scored that night, but and then the final was in December against Hibs, and it was the most miserable, dark, horrible day, and Hibs had been in extremely good form in the first half of the season. I remember Eddie Turnbull was their manager, and they were top of the league at that point. And they beat us 2-1 in the League Cup final. They played well. Pat Stanton scored second half, and then Jimmy O'Rourke scored with a great diving header. And then Dalglish got one back for us with a solo goal. But I think the general view was that we hadn't played particularly well. Hibs were maybe the best team in the country at that point of the season. And I think it was their first trophy for quite a long time.
And, I think Eddie Turnbull had indicated after the Driver Cup final that he thought Hibs would be the main challenger to Celtic. And he thought that they would give Celtic a game whenever they played them. And I think they played brilliantly in that final.
It's worthwhile pointing out at this stage that Hibs were an exceptional team. They'd just beaten Sporting Lisbon. I think it was 6-1 or 7-1 at Easter Road. But before that final, so they were clearly a team on form. They'd also took Rangers on at Hampden, and I think it was 1-0, but for memory, it was one of the games that they dominated. So when they came to playing us in the final, there was maybe no surprise that the Hibs won, because as we've said there, that they were the team on form. But and then a few weeks after beating us, they went to Tynecastle and very famously annihilated Hearts by 7-0 coming through. But the League Cup final where we lost, my recollection is being in the house, my dad was at the match, and we were listening to it, and what he liked to call the wireless, which was this big bulky thing that had all these cities on it all over Europe. And it amazed me why they called it the wireless, because there was about 40 wires in the back of it coming out of it. But anyway, I'm digressing, because when Dalglish scored, the last 10 minutes was all Celtic. And I remember as a young boy sitting at a wireless desperate for him to get an equaliser, but the equaliser just wouldn't come.
Yeah, I think Dixie Deans was injured and didn't play. And as we saw over Dixie's Celtic career, he was usually good for a goal or three when playing against Hibs. So he was a big loss for us that day. And you mentioned Hibs beating Sporting Lisbon 6-1 in the European Cup Winners' Cup, which was a phenomenal result. In the next round, they beat a team, I think, from Turkey or Albania. They beat them 7-1. Mm-hmm. And they were absolutely flying. They beat Ayr United 8-1 in the league. And as you say, that win at Tynecastle on January 1st, which I remember as one of the first games I ever watched on colour television. And they were the best team in the country up until maybe some point in February.
They drew at Parkhead the week before.
Yeah.
The Christmas game.
Yeah, they drew on 23rd of December, they drew one each. So they were
Jogstein had said sometime that season that in all future Celtic Hibs games we would play in all gold, because it was at the players' request that they felt that when the two teams played in their first choice strips that there was just too much green on the field. So that League Cup final and the Christmas game at Parkhead, which finished one each, we did play in the old gold strip, but by the end of the season we'd reverted back to the hoops. So I think it may have been more in relation to these games that were floodlit in the winter months that for the players, but you know, in the better weather in the spring and summer months we reverted back to the hoops.
The remarkable thing about Hibs that season, be interesting to speak to a Hibs fan, because they finished the season, they lost 8 league games, right? And they drew 7. But of the 8 league games, 5 of those losses were in the last 8 games of the season. In the final 8 games of the season, they lost 5 and drew 3. They went to the 13th of March and then didn't win another game out of the next 8 games. They lost 5 and drew 3. It's an amazing record at the end. And the European Cup, the Cup Winners' Cup, they're doing okay, and then they lose 3-0 away to Hajduk Split during that period.
What happened to the Hajduk Split game is interesting, because in the first leg, they were 4-0 up and they were coasting, and they lost 2 very soft goals near the end of the game, which Eddie Turnbull was raging about. And that meant that when you were going to Yugoslavia, as it was then, with a 2-goal lead rather than a 4-goal lead, the 4-goal lead should obviously be enough for them. And they lost 3-0. So in essence, they were 4-0 up and they lost 5 goals to go out 5-4. And that absolutely gutted them, because they were in with a real good chance out going all the way that season. The other thing about Hibs is, like a lot of the other sides at the time, they they had nobody to replace their key men. And I remember John Brownlee had a really bad leg break. Now, at that point, John Brownlee was ahead of the game in terms of international football, much more so than Sandy Jardine or Danny McGrain. And Brownlee at that point was, you know, he was said to be the best fullback in the country. Now, when he got injured, and I think off the top of my head, and I would need to check this, I think Alec Cropley got a bad injury as well. Hibs didn't have the squad to replace quality like that. And you're quite right, Harry, because at the end of the season, without those two guys and the disappointment of going out of Europe in such a fashion, they fell away to blazes, to be honest.
Well, I'm just looking at that. It's incredible, actually. From the what date would it be? From the 28th of February to the end of the season, Hibs played 15 games. And from the 28th of February, in those 15 games, they won 3.
On the 28th of February, which I checked the date, was the day they played Rangers at home in the Scottish.
Yep.
Hibs were going for the quadruple.
Yep.
They were top of the league. They'd won the League Cup. They had Rangers at home in the Scottish Cup, and they had Hajduk Split to come in the European Cup or this Cup. And as St Anthony's just said, injuries cost them. And, you know, when you go to the last game of the season in the league, when we're going to Easter Road on our last league game, you know, we got them at the right time.
But it's quite incredible.
What could have been a really tense fixture for us was a bit easier than it would have been 2 months earlier.
Actually, from the 24th of February, they played 16 games. They drew, they won two, drew one, two, three, four, five, drew five, and lost the rest. That's quite a run, as you say, Robert, for a team that were in for the quadruple to completely, and it's like Rangers 2019-20 form, that is. It's incredible. But back onto us. So we lose another cup final. That's actually twice at Hampden. We've lost to Hibs this season that we're talking about when we lose the League Cup. So that's the League Cup going. Let's get to the league. So we start the league off with a 6-2 victory over Kilmarnock. And the first Celtic Rangers game of the season, as is normal at this time, is the third game of the season. It's at Celtic Park, and it's a 3-2 victory. Was anybody there?
Well, I wasn't there, but I'm only going to share a wee story with you. That was the first time that we went abroad as a family to Mallorca, and we come back the day of that game. Now, I think it was either a 12 o'clock or a 1 o'clock kickoff. And very fortunately for my dad, he had an early flight. And I remember getting into the House and Govan, and he literally threw in the suitcases and bolted back out the door to get to Hampden to watch that game. But he wouldn't take me because, obviously, you know, Celtic Rangers games were very violent in those days. And had it been any other team, this was the first season I went regularly as a boy, and I remember most of the home games. But I remember the frustration of sitting in the house seething at him running out the door to go to Hampden, and he wouldn't take me. But I remember him coming back, and in later years, he said, of all the occasions that he'd seen Celtic play Rangers, he'd never seen a gulf like that game. Really? He said it was 3-1, your own 10-1.
Yeah.
And I think Celtic scored the third goal in 50 minutes to go 3-0 up. And he was annoyed in later years that Celtic started showboating. George Connolly was then keeping up. Jimmy Johnson was beating three men and then going back and trying to beat them in another direction. And he says Rangers were there for an absolute doon. He says, and we let them off the leash. And then that's the famous game where Greg scores the consolation goal in the last minute at the Celtic end of the ground, and the Celtic end cheered them, and he gave them a wee sort of a wee fist pump for good measure. But my dad says that although a lot of guys were noising Greg up, he said a lot of us respected him because he was the only Rangers player who kept going to the death when the rest of them had chopped it about half an hour previously.
Anybody else there?
Well, I remember the first league game at Kilmarnock, beating Kilmarnock 6-2. The game was at Hampden on a Saturday night, and I had again, because of our fire in the main stand, it was a dreadful crowd. And we beat Kelly 6-2, and the man of the match was Ali Hunter, the Kilmarnock goalkeeper, who would join us 3 or 4 months later. Yeah, the Rangers game that St Anthony's just talked about is famous for being one of the most one-sided games. And this was Jock Wallace's first match, as first Old Firm match as Rangers manager. And they'd got off to a bit of a rocky start that season. They had, of course, finished the previous season by winning the European Cup Winners' Cup, but then getting banned from Europe for 2 seasons by UEFA because of the crowd trouble. And Willie Waddle had managed to negotiate a reduction in the ban to 1 year. So Rangers were not playing in Europe. They were not able to defend their trophy. And I think they had a hangover because of that. And they had managed to get through their League Cup group, but they'd been beaten 4-1 at home by St Mirren in one of the group games, which was a meaningful game. It wasn't a dead rubber. And a guy called Ali McLeod had scored all 4 goals for St Mirren today. So, we'd suffered with Derek Rylance of Arbroath, and they suffered with Ali McLeod of Hibs. But, of St Mirren, rather. And then they had lost, in the League Cup quarter-final, they lost at home to Stennis Muir in front of one of the lowest crowds ever at Ibrox. So they had gotten off to a pretty bad start. They lost a couple of league games early on. And this was to come back and haunt them, because in the second half of the season, Rangers did very well. They were unbeaten.
Mm.
But they went through a bit of a crisis, I think, post-Barcelona. They sold Colin Steen in October to Coventry City. They sold Willie Johnson a few weeks later to West Brom. You know, arguably, you know, their two best goal scorers. Both of them had scored over 100 goals for Rangers, but both of them had disciplinary problems and were missing a lot of games because of sendings off. So it was a very difficult start for Jock Wallace his first 4 or 5 months. And when you look at more recent cases of managerial failure, like Pedro Caixinha and Tony Mowbray for us, you know, managers don't get much time when things are that bad. And anyway, Jock Wallace managed to survive his first 4 or 5 months at Ibrox. And of course, they lost that League Cup semi-final, as we mentioned already, to Rangers. So nothing much went Rangers' way up until the turn of the year.
I think they lost they only won 2 of their first 5 league games that season, which, you know, we all know exactly what sort of pressure that starts to put on managers. And then you can see the impact on attendances of 17,000 and 14,000 and 21,000 and 17,000 at league games that they've got following that run.
Actually, very low gates was a feature of that season. The Celtic gates were very poor that season in comparison to what had gone before. Actually, in that book that Tom Campbell and Potter wrote about Jock Steen's Celtic years, that was one of the things they highlighted in that season, was that there was a sad, marked decline in all the gates around Scotland. And it was almost as if this inevitable march that Celtic had towards the title every year had begun to pale with people, and there was no real challenge. It's even games away from home, people weren't turning out to see the Celtic because they anticipated a defeat.
Well, we are only a couple of years away from a 10-team top flight, so I've no doubt that this was one of the precipitating factors in the discussions towards getting rid of a top flight of 18 teams.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just what Robert was saying there about Rangers, I think as Wallace has come in, it took him a wee while to sort things out, and it becomes noticeable at this point. Rangers become a much more physical team. They signed Tom Forsyth, who was a very physical player, and who would be a great servant to them for a number of years. They also had Derek Parlane up front, who was probably probably a more physical presence than Colin Steen had been before it. And they signed a guy for Coventry, part of the Colin Steen deal, called Quinton Young, who was a reasonable winger on his day, but again, he was a hardy type. You know, he wasn't your wee winger who you could intimidate. Quinton Young to battle, and so that it's becoming noticeable that Rangers are as the season goes on, they are becoming a more powerful team, not an especially good footballing team. But they're becoming harder to beat, and that was reflected in the results as the season went on.
I think describing Tom Forsyth as a physical player does him an injustice. He was just a thug.
Well,
but Derek Parling started out as a wing half, and they moved him up to striker, and he was a very, very pacey player, and that pace came back to haunt Celtic in later seasons, because he was very quick.
It did, yeah.
So we beat Rangers, and actually our next game after that was the Bobby Charlton testimonial. We drew 0-0 with Manchester United. That was our next fixture that we played. Then we played in the League Cup against...
Just on the Old Trafford game, I was...
Yep.
Sitting down for breakfast the next morning, and my dad was sitting there and he was yawning his head off, which was not like him. He was a bit of a morning person. And it transpired that he'd gone to Old Trafford the night
without you.
Without me.
Oh, boo.
I was not happy. I think he'd only got home at 3:30 in the morning or something like that. And I was really disappointed that he hadn't taken me, but he'd obviously gone with his pals and, you know, gone to the pub and, you know, didn't want me around. And apparently Celtic played brilliantly. And a lot of suggestion that they deliberately didn't score. They missed so many great chances, but they didn't want to spoil Bobby Charlton's evening. And, you know, whether that's true or not, who knows? But it was a full house and tremendous match.
See, well, we're talking about...
No George Best that day.
Well, we're talking about Man United. It's probably... proper that we discuss this, because Frank O'Farrell was doing very badly at the time, and even as a young boy I remember thinking, you know, Man United, Best, Law, Charlton, Willie Morgan, great players, but they kept, each week it was passing, they were getting beat by Crystal. I'm sure that's the season that Crystal Palace beat them 5-0, the big Yogi scored one of the goals of the season in England. But the reason why I'm raising this is within a matter of weeks of that testimonial game, Frank O'Farrell was sacked and Tommy Docherty moved in. And that was a bad thing for Celtic, because the first thing Tommy Docherty did, and we'll maybe move on to that in a wee bit, is that Macari was becoming very unhappy at Celtic. And it's kind of annoys me a wee bit that he agitated for a move for quite some time. He said a few hurtful things in the press in order to try and get a move. And in later years, when Celtic fans would laud Macari because he wee Louis, and he plays for Man United, he was a great Celt. Wee Louis caused a lot of grief on the way out the door at Celtic, so he didn't. That should be forgotten.
Yeah,
but lots of people have caused grief on the way out the door. I mean, I always talk about Wim Janssen, to me, is a hero for winning the league, but I don't hold him in the reverence that other Celtic supporters did, because he did a huge big jobby on the front doorstep and the way out the door and stuffed their club for 18 months with his behaviour. Mm-hmm. But fans ignore that.
I think Macari, I had a look at his book, so this is his own spin on leaving Celtic, was that at the end of the 71-72 season, after we'd beaten Hibs 6-1, Tommy Docherty wanted to take 5 Celtic players to
Brazil,
South America, Brazil, yeah, for a tournament that we were playing in. And he wanted to take Murdoch and McNeil and Jinky, Macari and Kenny Dalglish. And Jockstein said no. And Macari was the only one that was allowed to go. And he did well, scored a couple of goals against Yugoslavia. Obviously spent a lot of time mingling with some of the Anglos and finding out how much money they were getting paid. So he went to see Steen. So this is in his own words. So he went to see Big Jock. He was on 50 quid a week in the summer of 72. And Big Jock offered him 55. as a, an improved contract. So McCarry said he wanted 100, and if he got 100, he would sign on the dot. McCarry's suspicion at that time was the top earners at the club were Big Billy and Jinky, who were getting 90 basic. But obviously, as we've just, St Anthony's mentioned before, there was a lot of bonuses and players could be making much more than that. Yeah. But anyway, he wasn't getting his 100 quid a week. And, you know, his last game for Celtic, and bear in mind at this stage, McCarry's been scoring vital goals against Ujpest Doza in the European Cup. He's scoring in Scottish Cup final victories. You know, he's a goal every other game. What I referred to last week as our Gerdy Muller, he was just so sharp in the box. He was only about 23 years old, and one of this kind of golden generation that were going to come through. And we certainly should have been able to meet him halfway. Mm. And I think the club was not interested in doing so. And he nearly went to Liverpool for 180,000. I think Bill Shankly thought he had the deal all stitched up in January 73. But Paddy Cremd, who was Doherty's assistant at Old Trafford, and they managed to get hold of McCarry. They offered him 200 quid a week, and they paid Celtic £200,000 for McCarry's signature. And I think the Celtic board felt that was decent business for a guy who was unhappy. McCarry also said there was other circumstances. He had just gotten married. He had more commitments. He didn't really...
He married an American girl, Robert. I think that's worth pointing out, because he clearly becomes quite a cosmopolitan character, because he married a girl. He didn't marry a wee lassie for Partick. So by marrying somebody American, I think he saw Glasgow as being quite a small environment, and he wanted to go somewhere maybe in a bigger league and in a bigger environment.
Yeah, very much so. So I think there was multiple reasons why he left. But the fact is, if we'd offered him 80 quid or something, he probably would have stayed happily, mm-hmm. because he loved the Celtic, and he turned out to be a great player for Manchester United for a decade.
Can I say something?
Yes.
Yeah.
I was reading in the Playing for Celtic book for that year, and there's a chapter in it where it sings the praises of this wonderful club chairman, Desmond White. What a wonderful man he was to replace Sir Robert Kelly. And I was intrigued that then you begin to enter the era where you're selling really good players.
Mm-hmm.
For this, when we look back over history, he was anything but a wonderful chairman. But
I think also
that coincides with the selling of McCarry, and then subsequently David Hay and things like that. People begin to leave because I don't think he was prepared to pay the players what they were worth.
Mm.
But it was the first signs that our ambition had decreased.
Yeah,
when we're willing to sell extremely good young players who were nowhere near their peak. So this wasn't sort of Wallace, Hughes, Gemmell.
That's what I mean.
This was far more devastating for the future of the club.
I also wonder,
and we haven't really talked about the European campaign, but the fact that we went out of Europe early that season may have also influenced the board in taking the money for McCarry, because I think not making it to the quarterfinals or possibly even the semis would surely have been costing us £100,000.
To sell a player of his ability and potential was exceedingly short-sighted, because when he went to Manchester United, he played up front for a wee while, but eventually became a very, very, very effective midfield player, Manchester United. He could score goals, but he didn't always play up front. And the potential was there. Everybody could see it. And it was very short-sighted just to take the money for a player of his ability.
I think it's important here that we point out for younger listeners that in these days, there was no freedom of contract. And as much as the clubs held your registration, and you could only leave for another club if your club agreed to sell you, which is why transfer fees began to escalate around about this period. So the fact that Celtic had control over Macari, over his future, and yet they opted to let him go, says a lot. But also, I think, I'm sure I read a quote recently where Jock Stein says along the lines of, this is at the end of the season when we win the league. He says, Macari would not be allowed to leave the club if I would have thought that it could have influenced our season in the league. So when you've got Kenny Dalglish, Dixie Deans, Harry Hood, Bobby Lennox, and a few younger boys underneath, there was still plenty of firepower in that Celtic attack, even without Macari.
But Hood, Deans and Lennox were all several years older than Macari. Yeah. And I think that was the short-sightedness that Lackey's just referred to, is, you know, we only got another couple of seasons out of Hood and Deans after this one. They were probably diminishing assets, whereas, you know, Macari could have been a good player for us for a decade.
Yeah.
Very disappointing. I was very angry at the time. And, you know, as I say, his last game was the defeat at Ibrox in January 73. And, you know, it wasn't a good period for the club. We were rocking at that time.
Well, I was going to take through very quickly, unless there's any games that stand out that some people want to talk about. After the first Rangers game, excuse me, we lose to Dundee in the league, beat Ayr United, draw with Airdrie, then beat Thistle, East Fife, win away in Aberdeen, beat Dundee United, beat Motherwell, beat Hibs 4-2, beat Falkirk away.
That was Hearts.
Beat Falkirk away, thumped Dumbarton, beat Arbroath, draw with Hibs, and then lose to Rangers. So is there any games in that anyone wants to talk about before we get to the second Rangers game, the one in January the 6th?
There's two games there I think stand out, certainly for me. The first one is the Aberdeen game at Pittodrie. I remember watching the highlights on television. There's a guy called Zoltan Varga, I'll not get into the details how he ended up at Aberdeen, but it was a fairly controversial character. But what a player this guy was. He was absolutely electric. And it was such a wonderful game of football that day. A 3-2 win for Celtic up at Pittodrie. A very open game, a very attacking game. Another game that I'd like to highlight as well is that the Hearts game in November 72 is the first time that I remember vividly everything that going to a game. I think the reason why I remember it is Hearts played in a very unusual Ajax-style strip. It was maroon rather than red, and it was aesthetically it was a wonderful looking strip, and the contrast between Celtic in the green and white and Hearts in the white and maroon always stays with me. Another thing I remember as well is it was one of the first times that went into the new stand. We would call it the old stand these days, the main stand, and the view you got was absolutely spectacular of the pitch. And it was a cracking game as well. Hearts were leading 1-0 and 2-1, and Celtic came roaring back to win 4-2 in the end. It was a boyhood memory. It's fantastic.
I would have picked the same two games, actually. And Kenny Dalglish scored fantastic goals in both games. He scored a diving header, which turned out to be the winner at Pittodrie. And in the Hearts game, he got an absolute rocket into the roof of the net. I think it was the equaliser for us that day. The only other one that I was going to mention was the game at Dens where we lost 2-0. And I cannot remember a single thing about going to that game. But I remember my dad and I ducking up a close after the match on that hill on the way down to the train station in Dundee as the Celtic fans went on the rampage. And it was quite violent. And there was shop windows getting smashed and there was people getting whacked. And not sure if running up a close was necessarily the best thing to do, but we actually survived it and then decided not to go.
Just as long as you're not with Lackey wearing an all-white outfit.
we decided not to go back on the football special and waited another couple of hours for our train home. But I think despite all this, we were well ahead of Rangers come Christmas because they'd had such a bad start. But we were behind Hibs, so we went into the Rangers game at Ibrox in January, not in the best nick because we'd had two games postponed because of a flu outbreak. And Big Jock had been taken to hospital. He was in hospital with a heart complaint or chest pains, and he was undergoing testing.
Was that Makariitis, Robert?
Makariitis, maybe. And we had the Makari situation. We had a bit of a hangover from Europe. We had a bit of a hangover from losing the League Cup. So I don't think we were in good fettle going to Ibrox on that day. And it turned out to be a bad day for us. And given how easily we had beaten Rangers at Ibrox, at Hampden back in September, I don't think anybody would have expected the turnaround in Rangers' fortunes to be so significant for the game in January. And it was a game where they got a penalty quite early on, which Evan Williams saved it. And Parlane had time to take a touch and roll in the rebound before the Celtic defenders reacted to try and clear the loose ball. So I thought, maybe an avoidable goal given that Evan Williams had saved the penalty for us. We then equalised with a shot that Dixie Deans smacked a shot and it hit off Dave Smith and went in. And a couple of place newspapers gave the goal to Dixie. Most gave the as an own goal for Dave Smith. And if it's an own goal, it meant Dixie never scored once against Rangers in his Celtic career, unfortunately. And I think a draw would have been a great result for us under the circumstances that day. Things had not been going our way, as I said, in the lead up to the match. But in the very last minute, Alfie Conn headed one in. There was no way back. And that put them
ahead.
Put Rangers ahead of us for the first time this season. They went a point ahead of us. Hibs were still top. And we had three games in hand on Rangers. But it certainly gave them a huge amount of confidence. And they remained unbeaten for the rest of the season.
The one thing as well here is Bobby Murdoch was always a huge player for Celtic, and he had been injured before the League Cup final, and Pat McCluskey had basically taken his place. Now Pat was wholehearted and he was committed, but he didn't have Bobby's passing ability and he didn't have Bobby's style. So I think at this point Celtic are struggling a wee bit in midfield for a bit of class. And there's definitely the Makari leaving, that there's probably a wee bit of hangover in the dressing room. And I think Rangers took advantage of that. But really what Rangers did to us that day was the exact polar opposite we had done to them the previous season in the new year fixture. It was a game that we should have won and Jim Brogan gets a winner. And, 12 months later, Rangers were a better team in the day, to be frank. And then in the very last minute, Alfie Conn get the winner. Although I think I recall Davy Hay was incapacitated and we'd use our subs. So Davy had to play on injured. And I think my memory is that if Hay had been fit that day, he would have won the header with Conn, but he couldn't get off the ground. And he let Conn get a free header and Rangers won 2-1.
It's interesting you mentioned Murdoch. Murdoch missed that game at Ibrox, as you said. He also missed both games against Duch Pestoza and he missed the League Cup final defeat to Hibs. So although this was Bobby Murdoch's, what proved to be his last season at Parkhead, when he was fit and healthy and the right weight, he was still a superb player for us. He was still a key man in the team. And Jack Charlton was to comment many times that he was very surprised that Jockstein let him go at the end of this season and he joined Middlesbrough and he had 3 or 4 very good seasons there.
Did you ever read, was it Eamon Dunphy? He wrote a book and he described the way he did it. Each chapter was a game in Millwall's season.
Yeah, Only a Game, I think it was called.
Yeah, and they went up to play, or Middlesbrough came to play them. They were challenging for the title. And he said that they lost, he said the chickens came home to roost and they lost that day to Middlesbrough. And he said that Bobby Murdoch was in the middle of the field. He couldn't tackle, he couldn't run, and he couldn't pass the ball. He says, but the whole game revolved round about him, and we were thrashed. Now, I thought, well, that's not true that he couldn't have passed the ball. But possibly by that stage of his career, he couldn't have run. But he was still the hub of Middlesbrough's team that won promotion.
Early in this season, there's a few games at the beginning of the season. Bobby actually plays at sweeper. If you read the reports, I don't remember this especially, but when you read the match reports, it was two or three games early in the season where George Connolly get pushed into midfield because probably had more legs, and Bobby gets to play behind Billy McNeil, and literally as a sweeper. And I often think that with the success of Pat Stanton a few years later, if that could have been a position for Bobby in later life at Celtic.
Pat Stanton was always quicker than Bobby. You know, Bobby was a quick player. I think when Celtic signed Stevie Murray at the end of this season, Steen had decided to adopt a different style of play, and Murdoch didn't fit into it because it was more push and run. You know, whereas, as I say, the game revolved around Bobby Murdoch when he was at his best.
There's no doubt Murdoch had more success in England than Gemmell, Wallace or Hughes, who didn't last long at all. And I think Steen felt Murdoch needed a new challenge. And, you know, he contributed so much to the club. I mean, one of our, you know, in a team full of stars like the Lisbon Lions, Bobby Murdoch was one of the greatest.
I thought he was the best.
It was seen as a great gesture when Celtic gave him a free transfer to go to Middlesbrough, because it let Bobby negotiate his own terms.
Yeah.
And I would think he would make, hopefully he would have made a fair bit of money out of that, because at that time, Bobby Murdoch in the transfer market, you could still get 40, 50 grand for him. Yeah. You know, like, he was still a valuable asset in as much as he could have been sold on for money. So I think in fairness to Celtic, it was to acknowledge the fact that he was a great servant to the club, and perhaps he never got a testimonial, but in some ways, it was made up to him in the fact that he could get the signing on fee rather than Middlesbrough pay a transfer fee. And I think that was a great gesture.
And Jackie Charlton knew what he was getting.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think after the Ibrox defeat, do you want me to keep going on the league?
No, okay, oh, yeah.
So Rangers, having taken confidence from beating us, won 12 straight league games. And we floundered quite badly. So at the end of January, we lost at Broomfield in what was Ali Hunter's debut for the club. And he went straight in to replace Evan Williams, and a guy called Kevin McCann scored the winning goal for Airdrie in the last minute. A couple of weeks later, we were playing Thistle at Parkhead, and Alan Ruff, a goalkeeper that we didn't go for until much, much later in his career, Ruff had a fantastic game. Celtic were trying to score their 6,000th league goal that day, and then eventually Bobby Murdoch got it in a sort of scrambled affair. But it was a 1-1 draw, and that was another point dropped. And then the week after that, we were at Methil against quite a tough East Fife team, and we were 2-1 down, and we got awarded a penalty. Bobby Murdoch hit the bar. The referee ordered the penalty to be retaken again, and Harry Hood's penalty was saved by Ernie McGarr, the East Fife goalie. In 87 minutes, we got awarded another penalty, and McGarr saved from Kenny Dalglish. In the very last minute, Dixie Deans scored a header to get us a 2-2 draw, but it was another, you know, under the circumstances, it was probably a 0.1 rather than a point drop. But these were games that we would have expected to win beforehand. And so we were dropping points all over the place, and therefore, you know, the games in hand advantage that we have over Rangers was dissipating. And as we said, Hibs had collapsed after the Hajduk Split defeat, and it came down to a two-horse race. And with two games to go, Celtic and Rangers were level on points, and Celtic were ahead on goal difference. And our last two games are both at home and Hibs away. And Rangers had Aberdeen away, East Fife at home. So basically, Rangers just needed to get more points than us, either 4 points to our three or whatever. And on the second last Saturday of the season, we were struggling badly against Arbroath, 0-0 at half-time. Brilliant sunny day that day, but a lot of tension. And I kind of moved to the jungle, so that was my big Bosman move this season. I'd moved from the back of the Celtic end to the jungle, and I was moving about a bit in the jungle trying to find the best spot. But I remember a lot of tension, again, a lot of people with transistor radios. What the hell was going on at Pittodrie? I think Rangers had led in that game at Aberdeen while we were drawing with Arbroath. But then Aberdeen came back. Aberdeen were winning 2-1 at Pittodrie. We stuck four in the second half, and we were about to be crowned champions that day at Parkhead until Alfie Conn scored again, a very, very late goal to get Rangers a draw. And therefore, it took it to the last game of the season. And as I say, they had East Fife at home, which was a game they won. And we went to Easter Road needing a draw to win. A draw would have won it on goal difference. I remember going on a supporters bus from Edinburgh Road. It was either from Carntyne or Cranhill that day. I hadn't been on supporters buses much. And maybe the first game I was at where I was a bit tipsy and, you know, I'd had a few cans on the way to the game. And so I'm a bit light on detail from the match. But, you know, we won 3-0 and it was a massive crowd there. I think 45,000, 46,000. According to the looking at the fixtures, and it was really fantastic atmosphere, fantastic lap of honour. Billy led the team round three quarters of the ground, you know, eight in a row, and it was the first time the Gary Glitter song had just come out. Hello, hello, I'm back again. So it was the first time we'd actually heard people just singing hello, hello, eight in a row, eight in a row, and so it was, I don't remember anything about the bus trip back to Glasgow after the game, but I thought it was a fantastic end to the season for us. We'd really had to perform in the last six or seven league games to see off, you know, what had been a huge challenge from Rangers.
What I remember is listening to the radio, playing football in Govan with friends, and as soon as Celtic went 1-0 up, I knew that was it. You know, I know that that's a bit sort of like a bit risky, but you know, there was just a gut feeling at the time. That's it. You know, if Hibs had taken the lead, it might have been another different outcome. But the fact that I remember when we scored one, and then it was 2-0, 3-0. And I remember my dad and my uncles come home that night, and with a wee sort of impromptu party in our house, and there was loads of crisps and sweeties and lemonade and stuff like that for me. But the men went to the pub, and they come back at night in time for the highlights, and we all sat and watched it. And again, that's another great memory. You know, that was a fantastic day. And I always remember people saying who were at that game, Easter Road that day, that literally at Easter Road in the street, but you just couldn't move for Celtic fans. It's estimated that 40,000 Celtic fans were there that day at least. When you think about that, that's a fantastic number to travel.
There was something in a book I read, and somebody might be able to add more to this, that Harold Wilson was in Edinburgh on that day, and he was not Prime Minister at the time. Edward Heath would have been Prime Minister. But he came out of that hotel, the one just at the top of the steps at Waverley.
The North British?
Yeah, whatever. I don't know if it's called that. It was called that then. And he came out just as thousands of Celtic fans were pouring out the station to walk down Easter Road. And according to the report, I read he looked a bit concerned. But everybody started chanting his name, and he's visibly relaxed immediately with all the Celtic fans chanting Harold Wilson. So,
so that season, it's something we touched on last season when we had five goalkeepers. That season, we had three people play as first team goalkeeper. Dennis Cunningham played 11 times, Evan Williams played 25 games, and then Ali Hunter, once he was signed, he played 22 games. Really just confirms, because this is something that continues, Jockstein just couldn't get the keeper situation right at the club. You guys were watching at the time. Were the keepers that bad, or was it? Was he just looking for something that wasn't there?
I think they
were scapegoats.
He never trusted goalkeepers. He was famous for that.
Yeah, I mean, he never even signed Ronnie Simpson.
Mm. They let him go.
Who'd been signed by McGrory. Ali Hunter, as I say, started with that defeat at Broomfield. Just the stats, I mean, he had 15 clean sheets in his first 22 games. And I think that was hugely important for us to, you know, eke out the points to eventually win the league. And, you know, he finished the season playing for Scotland at Wembley. In a game we lost 1-0. And we all thought at the time that Ali Hunter was the answer. And Jock had been quoted as saying, I think Ali Hunter can be your goalie for the next 10 years.
The only thing that I don't know how about you, Robert, but did you maybe feel that Ali Hunter was a bit in the small side for a keeper? That's my memory. I don't know if that's borne
not
out.
Really.
I remember and thinking that he wasn't as tall as some of the other guys.
I don't think it was so much that he wasn't tall, he was slight. He was a very slight guy.
I played against him in Hong Kong about 15 years ago, a kind of charity game, and sat next to him at dinner, and he was still in good shape. Don't know how old he was then, but the nicest guy that you could ever meet. And he said he never went back to Parkhead for reunions, ambassador work, nothing. You know, he was pretty sore about the fact that he was discarded quite quickly. And, you know, the 10-year plan turned into a sort of 2-year reality. And, you know, Hunter was, I think, gone by about 75 when Peter Latchford was signed. Mm-hmm. I think the view was that he was an improvement on Evan Williams. And I think Hunter's worst moment, and, you know, maybe the crisis in his career came a few months after the end of this season when he played in the Scotland-Czechoslovakia game at Hampden, which was the game to see whether Scotland could qualify for the World Cup in West Germany. And he let in a shocking goal at his near post, which thankfully didn't matter at the end of the day from a Scotland point of view. But I think from Ali Hunter's own confidence, it may have had an effect. And, you know, by halfway through the following season, he'd lost his place again to Dennis Conaghan.
I think what's interesting here is that as 1973 begins, Celtic's transfer activity has been pretty low. I mean, I think you had to go back to late 71 for Dixie Dean signing. And yet, when you get into 73, they've got the Macari money, certainly. But they buy Ali Hunter, they buy Andy Lynch, and they buy Stevie Murray at the very end of the season. So I think there's the big Jock had been looking to the future. And as much as these were three signings that he felt that were going to keep Celtic ahead in the years to come, and it never really materialised for the three of them. Hunter, as we've already discussed, Andy Lynch had to revert to left back in order to get a game. In his own admission, he was out the door. And Stevie Murray sadly got an injury and that curtailed his career. So I think that as we will talk about in the next few weeks, there's a lot of bad luck about Celtic Park at the time, which was It was almost as if fate was taking its toll.
Well, there wasn't bad luck in the Scottish Cup because once again, well, actually, a remarkable thing happened in the Scottish Cup this season. Celtic got a draw away from Glasgow, but they didn't have to travel too far. It was only to Motherwell. We were at home to East Fife. We were incredibly, based on the last umpteen seasons, we actually got an away-from-home cup draw to Motherwell. Then we were drawn at home to Aberdeen. We drew with them, so we had a replay in Aberdeen. Then semi-final, we drew with Dundee. We then beat them in the replay, and then we lose to Rangers in the final 3-2 on the 5th of May, 73. So who wants to take us through that?
On you go, Robert.
On you go, St Anthony.
All I was going to say there is that the game that sticks out for me is the replay against Aberdeen, because younger listeners will be totally amazed that we didn't even have teletext in those days. You certainly didn't have mobile phones. Excuse me. And in order to find the score at some time, it was great difficulty. And I remember listening to the old sports desk at 9:55 in Radio 2, which was obviously London. So the Scottish results were almost like an afterthought. And the guy says, here is the replay result. And you're working yourself into a frenzy because, you know, there's no preparation. It's just that this guy is going to tell you whether you're through or not. And he said, Aberdeen 0, Celtic 1. Didn't he tell you who scored? We didn't find that out till the next day when you bought the newspapers. But it's just an indication of how technology has moved.
Yeah.
It is on.
The Aberdeen
no one who scored the goal.
The replay was on was on Sports Scene that night, because I remember watching it. And I think, you know, if it had been on at 10:15 or something at night, I definitely did not know the score when watching the highlights of that game. And, you know, Big Billy scored with a header in the very last minute. And I'd been at the first game at Parkhead on the Saturday, which was 0-0. And again, when Jimmy Johnson got sent off by enemy number one, Bobby Davidson, and it was right in front of me in the jungle. And I think he was getting pulled by Jim Hermiston, the Aberdeen left back. And I think Jimmy lashed out, but didn't connect. And Bobby Davidson sent him off. This was, I think, quite early in the second half. And it finished 0-0. And again, a lot of controversy about this decision. You know, another Bobby Davidson moment at Parkhead. And at the end of the day, Jimmy got cleared by an SFA disciplinary panel, and he didn't serve a suspension. And indeed, he played in the replay. So he wasn't even banned for the replay on the Wednesday night. And Aberdeen, you know, all our games against Aberdeen were tough. You know, we'd gone about 2.5 years without beating them up until this season. You mentioned the 3-2 win at Pittodrie, 3-2 win in the League Cup semi-final, 3-2 win in the Drybrough Cup semi-final, and then these two tough games in the Scottish Cup. So that was, you know, the two Dundee games in the semi were pretty poor games. 0-0 first game, and then 0-0 in the replay as well on the Wednesday night, and then we won it in extra time. And so we were going for the first time in our history, we were trying to win three Scottish Cup finals in a row when we took on Rangers on the 5th of May, and, you know, an achievement that we didn't actually manage until last May against the Hearts. So I think history was against us in that final. It was the centenary of the Scottish Cup. I think it was the 100th. It was either the 100th year of the Scottish Cup or it was the 100th final. I think the 100th year. And it was Rangers' centenary as well. And there was a member of the royal family was at the final to present the trophy. And, you know, to the neutral, if there are neutrals at Old Firm games, that it was a fantastic game. We scored first. Great goal by Dalglish. Parlane equalised just a bit quicker to react to a cross than Billy. And they scored in the first 20 seconds of the second half, where Conn's pace got him away from Big Billy and he slipped one, went under Ali Hunter. We equalised pretty much straight away with, you know, fantastic move down the left, and Dixie Deans had a shot which John Gregg made one of the saves of the season on the goal line with his hand. You know, and of course, under modern rules, or, you know, any time in the last 20 years, John Gregg would have been sent off for stopping that shot on the goal line. It continued Dixie's, you know, unlucky streak against Rangers. Anyway, Big George Connolly stroked the penalty away. And then the key moment for us, I think, 5 minutes later, Wee Jinky got a goal disallowed, where he raced through, flicked it over McCloy and put it into the net, and it was offside, was given. Quite a controversial decision. The referee was not Bobby Davidson. It was someone who became equally infamous amongst the Celtic support, J.R.P. Gordon from Newport on Tay, who was very controversial. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they got their goal. Forsyth scored from 2 inches. And my memory of the last 20, 25 minutes or so is that we didn't really look like rescuing the game or taking it to extra time. We didn't have clear-cut chances. Quite a lot of huff and puff, but, you know, it continued this very worrying losing streak in cup finals. And in fact, we'd lost 3 cup finals at Hampden this year, including the Dryburgh Cup final. And I think something like 8 or 9 losses in our last 11 cup finals in all competitions.
It was the last ever 100,000-plus crowd at a game in Scotland.
Yeah, yes. Yeah.
It's 122,000, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because the next big game at Hampden was the Scotland-Czechoslovakia match that I just referred to, and the crowd was capped at 100,000 for that game and thereafter.
My dad used to buy the Sunday Mirror every Sunday, and his main reason for buying it was that Jock Steen had a column in it, which was written by Roger Bailey. And I remember after the final, Steen was recollecting why they'd lost the final, and he very much regretted the fact that he hadn't played Harry Hood that day, because Harry had a great habit of scoring against Rangers, and he was such a creative player. And I think on the day, as Robert said there, the last half an hour, we ran out of ideas a wee bit, and I think Harry Hood being there might have been a good thing for Celtic, and as much as he was a creative player. Another thing as well is he left Bobby Lennox at the bench, and after that, in the next season, Bobby wasn't in the bench very often. So I think the two things that another thing as well is, Robert, you may remember, did Jim Brogan get carried off that day?
Yeah, Lennox came on for Brogan.
Yeah,
because as Rangers were waiting to take the free kick.
Yeah.
Which produced the winning goal. So Tommy McLean took the free kick just as we were making that substitution. We had nobody on either post because Derek Johnson's header hit the left-hand post, rolled along the line, hit the right-hand post, and Forsyth was standing there on his own. So it's a position that Jim Brogan might have been in, quite frankly. So they always say never make a substitution when you're defending a set piece. But
big Forsyth then doing that for years to come as well, so isn't it?
The Celtic team that day, for people, was Hunter McGrain, Brogan, Murdoch, McNeil, Connolly, Johnson, Dalglish, Deans, Hay and Callaghan. And I suppose that's one of the things why it's so difficult to be a manager, the comments you're making there, St Anthony. It's easy in hindsight. You know, it's like when you go on Twitter and everybody says, well, I wouldn't have picked that team. Mm-hmm. It's easy in hindsight to say you should have played Harry Hood. That season, Harry Hood had scored 16 goals in 34 starts and 12 substitute appearances. Dixie Deans had scored 32 goals. Ken Dalglish had scored 40 goals. Mm. You know, so, you know, you can see why he plays the team that he did. Maybe with hindsight, he looks at it differently. Lennox had scored 17 goals. So you can see why he did it.
Uh-huh.
And then looking back, right, okay, maybe I shouldn't have done.
But I think his point was maybe that Dixie wasn't scoring against Rangers, and it was becoming noticeable. Whereas Harry Hood very rarely failed to make some impact against Rangers, whether it was scoring goals or creating goals. Horses for courses.
The other thing I remember about the game is that Derek Johnson was at centre half, and he was an outstanding centre half. He really was, and the game we mentioned at Wembley when Ali Hunter made his debut for Scotland, Derek Johnson played centre back again alongside Davy Hay and Jim Houghton, and they were up against Channon, Chivers, and Clark, which were a pretty fearsome trio of England strikers, and the Johnson, Houghton, Davy Hay were all fantastic that day at Wembley. So they had Derek Johnson alongside Forsyth at the back. And but I think what won it for Rangers was the pace of Parlane and Alfie Kohn and Quentin Young up front. And so the gamble to get rid of Colin Steen and Willie Johnson paid off for Rangers.
There's an apocryphal story about Alfie Kohn when he played for Celtic, and when McNeil came back as manager and Alfie wasn't getting the team, that they had an exchange about something about Kohn not being fit and not pacey enough, and he made a comment about being pacey enough to run by him in the cup final. And Billy McNeil did not take that well.
You were away from Glasgow for most of that season, Lackey.
I was.
How was it to be a remote from a losing cup final?
I think it was worse in a sense that you knew they were playing and that it wasn't even covered in the media down there. But where I was, there wasn't a lot of media facilities anyway. But you just got the results in the paper. I just had to grin and bear it.
So we have lost the cup. We've won the league. We've lost the League Cup. And then we've got European football. And we beat Rosenborg home and away in the first round of the European Cup. And then we're up against Újpest Doza again. But this time we lose. We 2-1 at Celtic Park and then 3-0 away. So it's quite a heavy away defeat. Robert, your thoughts that season's European campaign?
Yeah, it was absolutely miserable. The Rosenborg at home game had been played at Hampden because Parkhead was still not ready after the fire damage. And, you know, we were a couple of goals up in that game. And I think cruising and maybe thinking we were going to run up a big win. And it was a low crowd at Hampden. And when the Norwegians scored in the second half, still with about half an hour to go, yeah, there was a bit of tension and we didn't play well at all and finished 2-1. In the game over in Trondheim, they were beating us 1-0 at half time. So at that stage, we were going out on the away goals rule. And we certainly rallied. Macari got a couple of goals and, you know, it looked comfortable at the end, 5-2 aggregate. The Újpest Doza game, just coming a few months after we had beaten them. But we commented in the last podcast about Újpest Doza being out of season when we played them in the quarterfinal in March 72. And when they came to Parkhead in October, they were very much in season and they were sharper and they were faster. And they were definitely better than us in the first half, and they were a goal up. Their great striker, Ferenc Benny, had scored. And there was an old bloke with a kind of cloth cap standing next to me in the jungle. And I'll never forget this. And I'll never forget that it was this game. And so every time we did a misplaced pass, he would say, "Aye, you couldn't have passed water." You know, and he would shout this out at, you know, Hood, Lennox, Deans, whoever. And every time Jimmy or somebody went down the wing and tried to cross and it didn't reach a Celtic player, "Aye, you couldn't have crossed the road." And he must have done this 40 times. And he said nothing else. That was his only two retorts to the action in front of us. And he started to annoy a few people because we were getting beaten 1-0. And I thought there was going to be a fight because that was all this guy had in his locker. You know, you couldn't cross the road and, you know, he couldn't pass water. or I've seen milk turn quicker. That was his third phrase for the evening. And I was just thinking of moving away, because in those days, if you didn't like who was standing next to you, you'd just move and find another spot. And then Dougley scored an equaliser to make it one each. And he turned round, this guy of the limited vocabulary, turned round and he shouted at all of us, "I tell you we'd be all right." And Dougley got another goal, 2-1, narrow leads. And the away game a couple of weeks later, this time no Liz Taylor, no Richard Burton in Budapest, no Murdoch, no McCarry, who was injured. And we were 3-0 down in about 20 minutes. And no STV coverage as well. The STV were covering the game, but there was a problem with the link. And we got no pictures, which turned out to be a good thing. And they absolutely battered us with their pace. And Evan Williams had a great game that night to prevent a worse score. And we rallied at some point. You know, Dougleish hit the bar. Big Billy had one cleared off the line. But they were a better team than us. And I had a wee look today to see, well, what happened to them in the rest of the tournament. And in the quarterfinals, which again, they would have been out a season, they went out on the away goals rule against Juventus, who went on to the final and lost very narrowly to Ajax. So, you know, I think an unfortunate defeat, and it, you know, it cost us money. I think it cost us a bit of prestige and morale, maybe cost us McCarry, and a sore one to take, just that we'd been so comprehensively beaten.
I remember a disappointment running home from school. It would have been about a tea time kickoff, maybe 5:30.
Four o'clock.
Was it as early as that?
Yeah.
Running home for that would explain why the rush to get home for school. Running home for school to get the TV on, and the bitter disappointment of the pictures not coming through from Hungary. And yet, I'm sure in the studio, Arthur Montford kept giving us an update, and then he kept saying it's 1-0, it's 2-0, and it's 3-0. I thought, oh no. And I actually remember my mother, I don't know if it was in a bad, obviously maybe in a bad mood, but she sent me for a haircut because it was so obvious that we weren't going to come back for 3-0. And she went, do something useful with your time. There's, I don't know, like 20 pence. Go and get your go to the barbers and get your hair cut. And I remember seething, getting into the barbers and sitting there thinking that you know, what had been such a day full of hope was such a disappointment.
Yeah, and I think we were confident, obviously, of beating them again. Strange tactics that night. He decided to play Pat McCluskey alongside Big Billy rather than George Connolly. Connolly did play, but he wasn't in his usual position in central defence. So George was in midfield, Davy Hay was in midfield, Callaghan, I think, played, but as we discussed before, we missed Bobby Murdoch on an occasion like this. But it was pace that beat us, and it was pace that beat us, as we discussed in the Scottish Cup final as well, a few months later.
So that was the end of that season. For reference, we won the league. That was the trophy. The league that season finished Celtic, Rangers, Hibs, Aberdeen, Dundee, Ayr United, Dundee United, Motherwell, East Fife, Hearts, St Johnstone, Morton, Thistle, Falkirk, Arbroath, Dumbarton and Kilmarnock and Airdrie were relegated. There's East Fife, mid-table. In that setup, and you know, for someone of my age, the teams of Fife would be in this order in terms of size of support and things like that. For some of my age, the teams would be Dunfermline, then Raith Rovers, and then whoever. And yet, all through this time, East Fife have been the ever-present Fife team in the top flight of Scottish football. To go over a few other things that were happening in that time, the 72 Olympics had happened in the September, and there'd been the kidnapping by the PLO of Israeli athletes, and then they'd been murdered by the PLO, the Israeli athletes. And in films, last week we talked about The Godfather being the top film of 2002 with the Poseidon Adventure number 2. The films this year were Paper Moon, Disney's Robin Hood, Live and Let Die, Roger Moore's first James Bond film, Last Tango in Paris, Magnum Force, The Way We Were, Papillon, American and Graffiti, The Exorcist and The Sting.
Some great ones there.
Aye, so that was 73 in film. Any particular memories of what life was like in the UK in 72, 73?
See the last tango in Paris?
Yes.
My granny went to Blackpool with my auntie Annie. They were in their 70s at the time. And it was horrible weather. And they wanted to go to the pictures. And my granny says to my auntie Annie, there's a good one. The last tango in Paris. I think they were a romantic comedy with Gene Kelly or something. Now, in fairness, do you remember the days that cinemas used to have commissionaires in the door?
Yeah.
You know, guys in a hat and a uniform and stuff. And the commissioner said to them, what is it you're going in for, ladies? And they said, Last Tango in Paris. And thank God, he said to them, do you know what this film's about? And they said, no, we don't have a clue. And he pointed them into, I'm sure they went to see Robin Hood, the cartoon version. Because that was the two films.
So when I mentioned earlier that Gary Glitter song, which the Celtic fans adopted for Hello, yep. Hello, Eight in a Row, it made me start thinking about some of the other songs that the fans sang with reference to certain players at that time. And I came up with three or four. And my dad was a big Judy Garland song, so he absolutely loved it when the jungle started singing Lou, Lou, Skip to my Lou. It was a Judy Garland song from the movie Meet Me in St. Louis, which was before our time. But does anybody remember the Dixie Dean song?
Is it Son of My Father?
Son of My Father.
Chickory Tip.
Chickory Tip. But the song was written by Giorgio Moroder, who who wrote the music for Midnight Express and a few other things. So that was a Dixie song. And I'm not going to ask you to sing it.
You're not going to sing, oh, Dixie, Dixie.
Now, what about the Kenny Dalglish song? Any thoughts?
Kenny had a couple of ones, but they came later on.
There was one around this time. Was that Lackey about to start singing Super Kenny, Super Kenny, Super Kenny Dalglish? But the other one was Kenny Dalglish. Everyone knows his name.
Yeah.
Can you remember?
I do remember.
By Jackie Lee.
I mean, I was born in 1970, right? Yet I can remember the Dixie Dean song, and I can remember. I can remember the Dixie Dean song more than I can remember Dixie Dean's playing for Celtic. Actually, don't really have memories of Dixie Dean's playing for Celtic, but I remember it. I remember the Dixie Dean song.
Remember
where did the Jimmy Johnson song come from?
On the Wing.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Was it like a TV programme or? Davey Hay had a song, which was, the song was Montego Bay, which was kind of, and that was a sort of Davey Hay. It was a guy called Bobby Bloom had a hit with Montego Bay, and that was the one we adopted for Davey Hay. But I can't quite work out where the Jimmy Johnson one came from.
In the back of Pemberley.
We sang the Harry Hood one about 3 or 4 weeks ago.
Harry had several songs.
Yeah, the only strong thing, other strong thing I remember from that time is quite excitement. My mum and dad had been to a dinner dance and coming back to tell us all the three boys that my mum had a dance with Davey Hay at the dinner dance.
Talking about Harry Hood there, there's one song. Do you remember there was a Roger Whittaker song about this time in the charts called Mammy Blue? It went all lines of Mammy, Mammy Blue, Mammy, Mammy Blue. And
it sounds like a
Harry
song.
Oh, Harry. Harry. Oh, Harry.
George's got it there. Harry Hood. So I remember being a very small boy in school, and that was a popular one at the time.
They also sang the Hare Krishna song for Harry Hood.
Yes.
Aye.
And that's now used for the Johnny Hayes song.
Johnny Hayes, that's right. Johnny Hayes.
Same song, same tune.
Well,
did I, at the time when I was on the buses?
Uh-huh.
I don't know if I told you this story. It was, you used to have a, above the conductor's seat, you used to have adverts, remember?
Yes,
I used to go on and write in tiny letters on these signs, very, very tiny letters, Viva Harry Hood. and every bus I went on, I used to write Viva Harry Hood on these signs. We were having our tea one night in the Bothy, and a Ranger supporter came in, and he threw his box, his ticket machine box in the corner, and he says, if I go on another effing bus and see that effing Harry, Viva effing Harry Hood, I'm going to go mental. We just sat there and said nothing.
Well, with the end of the Harry Hood fan club, the Harry Grug, complete digression here. Does anybody remember? I always remember this, and there was never any follow-up of it. Completely nothing to do with that, but just you wrote it very small so that nobody really, really noticed. John Menzies in Argyle Street started to have a problem in the mid-80s or the early 80s because someone was going in, and any book or magazine that had a picture of Yul Brynner, they were going in and cutting it out. I remember reading an article in the paper about the secret Yul Brynner thief, and there was never any follow-up on it. Anyway, just your secret Harry Hood graffiti artist stuff there, Lackey.
Oh, but just one other wee song, it just came in my mind the other night. Again, it's more to do with, it was probably less sung in the jungle than it would be in the school playground. But it was all along the lines of, his name is Kerry Dalglish, he's the leader of our team, the finest centre-forward that the world has ever seen. He's here, he's there, he's everywhere to score a vital goal. And as for Derek Parling, you can stick him up your hole.
Oh, my.
I remember that one well.
Well, with that... it's with that tremendous story there at the end there. Stick it up your hole. I will say thanks very much, Lackey, Robert, and St. Anthony.
Good man.
I'm coming home, I've done my time. Now I've got to know what is and isn't mine.
Up your hole indeed. So if you were watching television, BBC One, which is all I can get the listings for this, if you keep wondering why it's always BBC One programmes, at the start of the season, it was the Munich Olympics, which we touch on. If you don't know too much about it, you should Google it. Incredible. If you think things have been difficult, challenging, horrendous, where we want to put it, with international terrorism in the last 20 years, you'd have thought the end of the world was coming in 72. So we have Olympic Grandstand starting at 10 o'clock, presented by Frank Boff, David Vine and Sam Leach. Don't really remember Sam. That finished at 7 o'clock. We had High Adventure, Back to God's Country. Then The Case, starring Cliff Richard with Tim Brooke Taylor and feature Newton-John. Then the news at 9:15, and then back to the Olympics with Today at the Olympics Games and Match of the Day, or it would have been Sports Rio in Scotland. Then on the last day of the season, when we defeated Hibs at Easter Road in front of 45,000 people, TV started off with weather, and then 11:30, Camberwick Green. Then Motormouse Gold on Crow Mountain, whatever that is. 12:30, Grandstand featuring Football Focus, again presented by Frank Boff. Then We Want to Sing, Ken Goodwin joins 300 children in a rousing sing-song. Goodness. Then the news at 5:30, Doctor Who, Planet of the Daleks, Part 4 was on. John Pertwee was the Doctor. And due to BBC cuts, they invented this. This is one of the few things I remember about Doctor Who at the time. I subsequently found out, they invented the storyline that the Doctor was marooned on planet Earth and couldn't get off it to cut down on the costs of trying to make far-off distant planets. So that was John Pertwee was Doctor Who, The Wonderful World of Disney, the Saturday Western, The Ride to Hangman's Tree was on at 7 o'clock, 20 to 9 was The Dick Emery Show, You Are Awful, But I Like You, Then A Man Called Ironside was on at 10 past 9, then The News, then Sports Reel, then Presenting Lena Martell, then, and that's one for Remy, then Sergeant Bilko at 10 past midnight would have been The Weather, and then Closed Down. And then just because the boys were singing it, there's a bit of controversy playing this particular artist. I tend to live in a world if you can't pretend he didn't exist. This is the song that the Celtic fans were singing. Hello, hello. It's 8 in a row.